So all of y'all understood chapter 1 and chapter 2, and you're ready to tell me what it means.
Jim McCoy is. Jim said he was.
Jim sat out by the pool. He should have been sufficiently open to just understanding.
But when I read three chapters, that would be the
C.S. Lewis, and it's interesting that we sang this hymn a few moments ago, and some of the words talking about looking above and let Him be our guide. C.S. Lewis, as he begins this series of talks on the BBC back in the 40s, the world was in the middle of war. There were questions about right and wrong, and certainly the Nazis were running rampant, and so there were really some questions about, for a lot of folks, about even whether there was a God. And if there was a God, then why didn't God stop the Nazis? Why did God allow those things to happen? Wasn't God in control? What was good and what was bad? In fact, for Uncle Adolf, his policies were pretty good, even though he knew they were really wrong, because they were very selfish. They were not selfless, but they were very selfish. And then there were others, of course, the Axis powers that sided with him and said, we're going to do this for selfish reasons, even though they knew that what was being done was very selfish and wasn't beneficial for the whole. They were looking beyond the whole just to a more specific, narrow kind of approach. And then you had the Allies, various Allies who saw what was happening under Adolf Hitler's guidance as wrong, as being against the conventional wisdom, as not being fair, and the way that he took on, and folks followed him for such. And so there were a lot of different questions around just what is fair? Where do we get the idea of good and bad, right and wrong? What is proper behavior and what is not? Lewis, as we know, and as we've said, Lewis was a self-avowed atheist. And as he began to set out to disprove the existence of God, he began to deal with these questions for himself. Really, this book, his series of broadcasts for the BBC... and remember, these things were done in 15 to 30 minute snippets or segments over the radio. People didn't have the opportunity to go back and reread it or listen to it again because they didn't have all of those devices to record, and so they were listening and paying attention, and there were folks that wrote to him. He says there were folks that wrote to him and asked him questions. And some of them he sought to answer, and others he said, I just let lie because I'm not the authority. This is me as a layman working through these questions and trying to, in some ways, give a defense, an apology, apologia, a defense of the fact that there must be a God, there must be something, or he will later come to someone, a person, behind all of this who sets the mores, who determines what is good and proper behavior, and not just for Christians. Although Lewis will say, I came to the conclusion that the Christian religion is indeed the best avenue and the best representation of that, but that there seems to be almost a universal sense that there is a law of what is right and what is wrong, and even though sometimes there are variations in how we practice that, people know that there are some things that are good behaviors and other things that are not across the spectrum. And so he talks about that as the law of human nature. He begins by, and I know y'all don't ever hear these things going on, but maybe back when you were growing up, you heard people quarreling and arguing. Quarreling, as he puts it, we say they were arguing or they're fighting. Over different things. For example, whether one person's behavior is decent or not, whether it's good or bad, whether it's selfish or selfless, whether there's fair play. You know, and people, and that's a difficult question sometimes when we start talking about God, because the question comes up, is God fair? And sometimes people say, well, yeah, God is fair because God's been doing good things for me. But then somebody whose lot hasn't been so good might say, well, God's not fair. And it's nowhere in the Bible that we're promised that God's fair. We're promised that God's just and that God's caring. And so as he gets to talking about these issues, he wants to try and get to that whole thing of fair play, decent behavior, and that there seems to be in his initial argument. And here he doesn't talk about God. He doesn't call it God in the first few chapters. He gets to that later. He wants to go from the standpoint, if you are an atheist or an agnostic, or you're just not sure where you are, at least coming at it from the standpoint that we know, we can see, we can experience that out there, there seems to be some kind of general law about what is proper and what is not, what's right and what is wrong. As he argues or talks here, he said, you know, if we didn't know that there was a right and a wrong, then how do we determine that what we've done makes us feel bad or hurt somebody else, or it's, you know, it's the wrong thing to do? How do we determine that there's something right? We have to have something out there to balance those two. And so there seems to be this universal out there sense of right and wrong. In arguing, he said, we seek two things when we argue with people, when we quarrel with people. First of all, we want to prove the other person's wrong, right? And we want to prove that we're right. Well, when we do that, then there is this, we are presuming, we have assumptions. We assume or we presume that there is an inherent sense of right and wrong built into people. Now, we as Christians, folks within Judaism, folks within some other religions, will immediately say, okay, well, that inherent, that innate ability to see that some things are right, some things are wrong, is put there by God. And Lewis will come to that point. But you also have to understand that part of what he's doing here is arguing from the place where he began after some tragedies in his family life when he was young, after spending time in the trenches in World War I, after seeing some other things that were going on. He decided, with all the evil in the world, with all the terrible things going on in the world, and not enough good, then there couldn't be a God. Of course, later, it'll be that same argument that will turn him from atheism to theism, realizing that there had to be a God to set that good and that which is right as opposed to that which is wrong. So, these first few chapters are not, by any means, the easiest stuff to read and to digest. And sometimes you have to read portions and then go back and come to it later again and read portions and maybe the same portion over again. But I do promise you, and Jim has read about all the way through the book recently, it does get more understandable as you move along. But Lewis, once again, is trying to show how there is this innate sense, this law of human nature that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, quite frankly. We have that ability to know right from wrong and to think it through and to make decisions rather than acting on pure instinct, and that is a major thing that separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom, the rest of creation, and it is also that that gives us the ability to find God. To find God. And he calls this the law of human nature. Something that we can choose to obey or to disobey. Now, how is that law of human nature then different from the law of gravity? For some of you who might have read, one of the questions is, here, law of human nature, expectation of fair play or morality. How does this law of human nature, differ from, we're going to jump over the speed limit, because y'all can choose to obey it or not. You just got certain consequences. But, especially on Highway 20, right? Judy. Or the law of gravity. She grinned, so that's fine. What's the difference in the law of gravity? And what does Lewis indicate is the difference in the law of gravity as opposed to the law of human nature? Right, Jim, you cannot disobey the law of gravity. You throw a rock, it's going to fall. You shoot a bullet, it's going to fall. You think you're going to fly off the church steeple, you're going to find out when you hit the bottom and become a very messy spot on the sidewalk or the parking lot. You can't get away from the law of gravity. That's something that is built into the system that you cannot disobey. Whereas the law of human nature that is inherent in people is something you can choose to obey or you can choose to disobey. It's that distinction between humans and the rest of creation. Now, for we who are Christians and for Jews, go back to where to see that ability to choose or to follow or not, to obey or disobey. Where's the first place we see that? In the Garden of Eden, in the stories in Genesis 2 and 3, where, actually in Genesis 2, God makes the man, then plants the garden, then puts the man in the garden to till it, to take care of it, to be a caretaker, and we can choose there once again. That's another distinction between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom, is we can choose to take care of it or not. The rest of the animal kingdom just goes through the motions, the instincts, but we can choose to do that or not. And then God looks and says, in that story, God says to the man, now you can eat anything you want to in here. You can do anything you want to in here except for this tree. You got to leave that one alone. Because you get around, messing around with that one, you're going to die. He didn't say, you can do anything out here. He didn't wall that tree off. He didn't not create it, but God puts it there and says, okay, you can eat anything, but if God didn't intend for a person to have that ability to make the decision to obey or not, to do what is right or not, law of human nature. Make that choice to obey or disobey. Why, A, why put the tree in there, and B, why call attention to it? And we know they talked about it, because in chapter 3, when the serpent's talking to the woman and says, God say you can eat everything, she said, well, we can eat everything except from this one. In fact, we can't even touch it. Which shows they had been talking about whether to obey or disobey. They knew inherently there was a right and a wrong to choose to follow God or not. So we as Christians and Jews would say it's God that gives us that choice. Lewis will eventually get to that point and say, yes, it is God that gives us that choice. And God that gives us that ability in the law of human nature. But here he's starting out and saying, there is this law, there is this understanding across the board that there are some things that are proper behavior. A criminal might argue otherwise, but I would then argue back that that's not how they began. But most people would say selfishness is not seen as a virtue in most societies in the world, right? Being selfish is not held up as a high virtue, something that you should aspire to do. No. We know that to be selfish means that we potentially hurt someone else and take away from someone else and keep from someone else. And while we might want to do that, we also know that the higher good for our survival and for living and for having relationship is not to be selfish but to share. Even though sometimes we don't want to share our candy and our gummy bears and things, right? I don't like gummy bears, but maybe some of y'all do. I remember my granddaddy Zachary, Doc, as I'm the one who gave him that nickname, but my grandfather Zachary, Doc knew when and where the fish were biting in farm ponds, in streams, in rivers. We never came back from fishing without a stringer full of fish. Never. And we went fishing one time with my Uncle Bob. And we came back. My Uncle Bob hadn't caught very much, but I'd caught a couple of three messes of fish that day. And we went to clean them. And Doc said, now we need to give some to Uncle Bob and we'll take some inside and let Zach, that was my grandmother, let her fix them and cook them. And I said to Doc, he didn't catch all these fish, I did. They're mine. And then he said, but Steve, he needs some too. We need to share. That's what we're supposed to do. And I'm a little fella, but I learned a lesson that day. I wanted to be selfish, but I learned that there's something larger out there we are to share, not to be selfish. We presume that there is such a thing as this law of human nature. It's wrong to steal. It's wrong to murder. I mean, you may kill somebody, but what does a person do when they run in and they murder somebody? They stand up and wave a flag and call the police and everybody else flag them down and say, hey, come here, I just killed him. Isn't that great? No, they know it's the wrong thing to do. They were selfish in doing it. They know it's the wrong thing to do, and so they run. They hide. Why? Because it's the wrong thing to do, inherently. And even in other cultures, kill in time of war, you kill when somebody's threatening you. But in general, well, I guess some of the Mayans were a little bit different, but in general, you didn't just run out and murder folks. Why? Because it wasn't in the best interest, it wasn't in the best behavior. Do you have to teach a child to swipe something off a store shelf? Something that they like? Do you have to teach them to take it? No. Yeah, you have to teach them to take it back or not to take it to begin with. We have these choices, and that's given to us, and that's what Lewis calls the law of human nature. Across the board, there are senses of right and wrong. And we have been given those choices. He goes on to say, you cannot blame a person who doesn't act properly if they don't know. If it's all instinct. If it's all instinct, you can't blame them. Just like the instinct of the puppy is to chew up your best pair of shoes. Not your old tennis shoes, but to chew up the best pair of dress shoes you got. That's instinct. It doesn't know any better. It doesn't know any better. So how can you... I mean, we get angry. We roll up the newspaper and we holler at it. We pop the little puppy on the nose or whatever. But can we really blame the dog? No, because that's instinct. The dog didn't know better. But we as humans are given that law of human nature where we have the ability to choose and we know better. We know how to act properly or not. We have this sense that we cannot have safety or happiness except in a society where people play fair, right? Can we be happy and can we be safe in society if people don't play fair? If people don't play fair, if people don't live by the proper codes? How do we feel if people are not living by those codes? Uneasy. And we have what? We have locks on our doors. We have security systems on our houses and our churches. And we even have alarms in our cars. Yes. And yeah, Vicky, with her house being broken into recently. So we feel safest and happiest where there's a society where people have a sense of fair play. Which also means that if people don't have that sense of fair play, then we don't have that security. And that's part of the law of human nature. I mean, if you look at other religions, Native American religion, a respect for the land. It was wrong to just take. Native American religion going way back. You only used what was needed. And you used the whole animal. You used the whole plant. Within Hinduism, there is this sense that you are not to do harm to other beings. If at all possible, you are to live in harmony with everything else. Not just everyone else, but with everything else. Of course, you got that old karma thing, cycle of rebirth, and you never know what you might come back as in there. But there's still that sense that there is a general right way and wrong way to act, and the wrong way to act is to be selfish and misuse and hurt others, and the right way to act is to be selfless and seek to do good the law of human nature. And that's what Lewis is talking about here. There, if you have doubts that there is a God, at least one of the avenues to start experiencing, stepping toward finding out if there's a God or not, is to look at the fact that we have this innate sense of right and wrong, decent behavior, etc. Buddhism, you are to do good, be deferential, give up all attachments and all ignorance so that others can benefit. In Judaism, we are to be, in Genesis, we are to be caretakers, taking care not only of the land and the earth, but taking care of each other. In Christianity, we're to turn the other cheek. Jesus said we're to take care of the outcasts. Paul says that we're to lift up others in prayer and work with them and take care of them. James says that true religion is to visit widows and orphans in their affliction and keep yourself unstained from the world. So throughout all of these, there is this sense we can find in most of these major religions, we can find this sense that there is out there somewhere an expectation. What is good behavior? What is wrong behavior? What is correct? What is not? And selfishness and greed are not a course of action to be admired. So, Lewis says then, if there is this law of human nature, the next thing we have to do is look at, on our journey, trying to understand where it comes from and to find our way to God, is then to ask the question, do we keep the law of nature? How often do we break it? You know, we expect others to be fair and consistently keep the law of nature in a positive way, but he argues we often fail to keep the behaviors we expect of others. Right? My prime example that I come to and is there are people who tend to stick certain ministers, deacons, elders, other folks on a pedestal or hold them to a higher standard than they themselves are willing, by which they themselves are willing to live. Y'all ever know anybody that way? They'll do certain things, but if one of the deacons does the same, oh, they're ready to run them over, right? I can't believe that they're supposed to live better than me. No, we're all supposed to live better. Right? So anytime we do those kinds of things, anytime we expect someone to be more holy than we, or we expect someone to act better than we in a particular situation, oh, well, they got all the advantages, they ought to know better than that. And then we don't, then anytime we do that, we're breaking the law of human nature. Yet, when we do that, we also understand that there is a law. Especially when we turn around and we know what we've done is wrong or questionable. What do? Lewis says we start making excuses. I was sniping or snappy toward my spouse. That was just because I was tired. I had a bad day at work. I was hungry. And supper wasn't on the table when I wanted it. And so she slammed her hand down and said to him, "You're supposed to..." I thought I might get a rise there or a laugh. Yeah. Or excuses. You know, I had a bad day at work. I was up late last night. I just couldn't get up and go to church, or I couldn't come to Bible study, or I couldn't do this. Or I was just so tired today. Lord, I couldn't even pray because I was so tired. Well, why do we make excuses? Because we know we've broken the law of human nature. Anytime we make excuses, we know that we are not living up to that highest ideal, which seems to be out there, that which is correct. Which is correct. Lewis says the question then is not whether the excuses are good. The excuses speak to how well we keep the universal law of nature. He says the truth is we've been in decency so much, we feel the rule of law pressing on us so that we cannot bear to face the fact we're breaking it. Consequently, we try to shift the responsibility or make excuses. And it's not just we who are Christians or Jews or Muslims. It's across the spectrum. It's even people who aren't necessarily religious. You catch people out here who aren't really religious. They don't go to church. They've never paid much attention to it, and they get caught in a bad action. What do? Start backpedaling, blame somebody else, shift the responsibility. Why? Because they knew they were wrong when they did it. So there is this inherent sense of a law of human nature. Universal sense that we should act in certain ways. We know the law of nature. We consistently break it. Oh, seems to me somebody in the New Testament said, you know, those things that I know I ought to do, I end up not doing them. And the things I know I shouldn't do, well, guess what? I do those too. A fellow by the name of Saul, also known as Paul. There was that sense. And he found it in other places too. He found it in people who worshiped the Roman pantheon of gods and the Greek pantheon of gods, in places where people weren't very religious at all, worshiping any gods. And so Lewis here starts arguing and saying the fact that there is a universal sense of right and wrong, choosing to obey or disobey, is a clue that there's somebody behind it all who has placed this within us. It's a clue to the meaning of the universe, as he says, and he's using universe here kind of like Plato does initially. Plato talks about the universe is in itself divine. The universe, all the universe itself is divine, is God. And so he says, as a starting point, philosophically, the very fact that there is a sense of right and wrong says there is there is meaning in the universe, and B, there is something or someone behind the universe. Even if you're not a religious person, there's something or someone behind the universe, that Stephen Hawking just recently said, well, he's changed his mind, there's not a God behind it all, because it's just too much suffering and everything else, and the Big Bang happened on its own.
Right and wrong ain't always that simple.
No, right and wrong's not always. Yeah. Right and wrong in the details is not always that simple. But out there in general, from society to society, there are certain things that seem to be almost universals about not being selfish and helping others, even if the ones you're helping are the ones that are your own folks, instead of you saying, well, the heck with David and Beth and Margaret and everybody else, I'm just going to do for me, and y'all go fend for yourselves. No, because you know that's not the right thing to do, right? And so, while in some of the details, right and wrong is not that simple, as a general concept, right and wrong, what is proper behavior and what is not, Lewis says, is a clue to the meaning of the universe and the fact there's a person behind it, and gives us that sense that will bring us toward God. And an admission that there is someone out there and a God. Now, he understands in chapter 2 that there are going to be some objections people raise, and he lists two of those major objections, which are on the handout that I gave last week. The moral law is just a herd instinct. Moral law is just herd instinct. And yet he argues about that. The desire to help, the herd instinct, is different from the sense that you ought to help no matter what. And he talks, if you remember some of the examples he gives, he talks about a drowning person. And he said, your herd instinct is to go the other way, not go in the water and help them, right? That's your herd instinct. Well, that's true, William. It could depend on who it is. But in general. Or let me go with a different example. You're in a mall parking lot, and you see someone who maybe is a total stranger to you, but you see a woman walking along with packages, with her purse, and she's headed to the car, and all of a sudden somebody comes darting out from between some cars, grabs her purse, and starts beating on her and trying to get the purse away. Herd instinct says, well, I don't know, or I'm going to go the other way. That's herd instinct. What Lewis would argue is this sense of moral right and wrong, this morality, will compel you, or should compel you, know what you ought to do. What you ought to do is go help her, right? Herd instinct says, I'm going to turn and run and get away. Morality, moral law, right and wrong, says what I ought to do is help. To go over to work on this person, etc. Herd instinct says is the stronger instinct, which is to run away. Now, if it's your family member, of course you're going to do that. But we're talking about a total stranger out here. It's just like a total stranger. If a child falls into a swimming pool, you don't know who they are, but the child falls into deep in a swimming pool, they start sinking, and they're drowning. You know. And you can't swim. Or you don't swim very well. Herd instinct says, well, I've got to stay back and holler for somebody else to help. That's the stronger instinct. But what Lewis argues is that if we, with this sense of morality and right and wrong behavior that is put into us, kind of as a universal, the lesser instinct, that is to go in and save this child, even though you may not be a strong swimmer yourself, is the one that what you ought to do, and what morality does is pushes you to eventually make the right decision and do what you ought to do as opposed to what is self-protective. And he argues that morality, which causes us to do that, to take the lesser instinct and make it stronger, the stronger instinct, and act upon it, not for our good, but for the good of someone else. Somebody that's not part of the herd. Our immediate herd. That is this law of human nature in God. Eventually he'll get to God. Here he doesn't. But God acting in and through us has placed that within us. Which then gives meaning to the universe and helps us to understand there is a person behind it because of all of this. It's a sense of ought to help no matter what, even if it puts you in danger or costs you. I liked his music example. We may be a jumble of notes at random. That's herd instinct. We're just a jumble of notes at random. But moral law, placed in us by this Creator behind it all, the moral law, which gives meaning to the universe, tells us or shows us the tune to play. It gives us the tune instead of tuning. That's what we used to say, you know, before when I was in an orchestra. You know, you'd be tuning your instruments ahead of time. Well, it was an ancient Chinese ritual called tuning. It has no, you know, but it's just a bunch of random notes out there. You know, you listen to it, there's no rhyme or reason to it except people are trying to get their instruments in tune. But what he says is, instead of that, that's the herd instinct. I got to get my instrument in tune. But then moral law, which goes beyond that, is we have to all be in tune, and moral law teaches us the notes to play, the tune to play. In other words, gives us that guidance. Moral law seeks to make us choose right action when the stronger instinct is to do less. And I would use another biblical example here, though Lewis doesn't. I would use another biblical example. I know I'm jumping ahead of him a little bit, or further down than he would want to be at this point. You know, this whole sense of doing more to less to protect ourselves and more to do the right action in the Psalms. We find in a few places where it talks about how we are to put ourselves aside and yet step out and help others around us and help guide us. And the rules, the laws of that are written on our hearts give us that guidance. Not just the laws that are written in books. Well, that law written on the heart is also, and it's also in Jeremiah, the law written on the heart is that sense of the law of human nature. Right and wrong to the universe. So are impulses good or bad in and of themselves? On page 11 of the book, Lewis argues no. Think once again of a piano. It has got two kinds of notes on it, right? And I'm not just talking about white keys and black keys. The right notes and the wrong ones. The moral law is not every single note is right at one time and wrong at another. The moral law is not any one instinct or set of instincts. It is something which makes a kind of tune, the tune we call goodness or right conduct, by directing the instinct. So it's not just random, as Lewis thought it was early on. It's not just random. By seeing right and wrong and following the tune through, following the way we are led, moral law directs us towards goodness and against selfishness. Moral law directs us towards goodness and against selfishness. And when we learn that moral law is directing us in that direction, sending us in that direction, then we come to understand through the whole sense of right and wrong and what is good for the whole, and the lesser instinct becomes the stronger instinct to help others. It helps us too, but it helps others. It helps the whole. Then we find that at that point we have to admit there's got to be someone behind it all. There has to be someone who is giving the guidance, who has given us the moral law, and who has placed it within the hearts, as Jeremiah says. If there's no rule of law, he goes on to say, another objection is that morality is just a social convention. But he says, if there is no rule of law, that is correct understanding of human law, we can't say that one way is better than any other in the world. And the world would never grow better or worse. He argues and says, we know that the Nazis are doing all these horrible things, but without the whole sense of moral law, right and wrong, not selfishness, but selflessness, how could we say that Nazism is worse than anything else? How can we say that the extermination of 6 million Jews is worse than anything else? If there had not been given this sense of right and wrong, we couldn't. All we could say is, that's just the way that they live their lives, and I guess for them, that's just as good as anything else. That's one of the things, and we hear that a lot. Quite frankly, with the postmodern era, the end of modernism and the beginning of the postmodern era, that's something that you hear more and more. There is no absolute truth for all of us. There's an absolute truth for me at this particular point in time, though it may change if I'm in another situation over here. That's postmodernism. That's what's running around in the 21st century now. That's why you can have folks, and it's especially prevalent from high school age, late high school age through 30-ish right now. It's a sense you can hold, not everybody's there, but a lot of folks, you can hold totally opposing ideas at the same time and not see them as opposing ideas, and you can do totally opposite things and never see a conflict between the two. That's also, I think, part of the reason there is a rise in something, especially out west, called the New Atheism, to try and say, it's simply all morality is relative, depending on your situation at any given point in time. And what is good and right today, if you're in a different situation, may not be good and right, but that's okay. Go by the situation and that's it. Instead of a sense that there is a given sense of moral codes and ethics that are out there that are universal. Now, it's that time. I didn't mean to talk this much tonight. No, I didn't. And I appreciate some of the input that some of you all have given. Any questions? Or do you need to kind of sit on this till next week? Yes. Okay, two random questions in the preface. Let me look here. So far as I can judge from reviews and from the numerous letters written to me, the book, in other respects, we omit the disputed points. We shall have left only a vague and bloodless HCF. The HCF turns out to be something not only positive but pungent, dividing from all non-Christian beliefs by the chasm to which the worst divisions of Christendom are not really comparable at all. I will have to look that one up, TJ. I will have to look that one up. And in the James is a Fool and an MA, he's talking about James is a Fool and a Master of Arts. Now, he's talking there, the word gentleman originally meant something recognizable, one who had a coat of arms and some landed property. That's what it meant initially for a gentleman. You had a coat of arms, you had land, you had serfs, you know, the three apples high and blue. No, that's Smurfs. But you had people that worked for you, etc., and you had that title. That's what a gentleman meant. Now, when you called someone a gentleman, you were not paying him a compliment, but merely stating a fact. He had that title because he had that land, etc., etc. If you said he was not a gentleman, you were not insulting him, but giving mere information. There was no contradiction saying John was a liar and a gentleman, any more than there is now in saying James is a fool and an M.A. And he's talking there about how language changes and how our understanding changes. For the British. For the Britishers in 42. But I will check on the HCF for you. Anything else? It'll get better. Here he's talking about somebody who's a fool and also has a Master of Arts. You know, master's degree. Next time we'll talk. We'll pick up. Think about this. We'll start with some questions, and then we'll pick up with chapter 3, the reality of the law, from there. Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace, and may your brain cells help you to ponder. Chapter reality of the law. Chapters 3 and 4, reality of the law and what lies behind it.